Inside Crime is brought to you by Deterra. The Deterra drug deactivation pouch provides an easy and effective way to dispose of unused or expired medication. Learn more at deterrasystem.com. Stay safe, stay ready with Deterra. I'm Angeline Hartman. I've spent my career as a journalist covering some of the worst crimes in history. My craft is storytelling. My passion is crime fighting. With this podcast, I'm bringing you more stories, candid conversations with crime victims, their families, and law enforcement. We'll journey together as we learn what happens inside crime. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Inside Crime and our season of Survivors and Heroes. Today's guest is Officer Sean Wyman with the Tallahassee Police Department. He's also a trauma-informed care speaker and a best-selling author. Last month in Tallahassee, a jury reached a guilty verdict in a quadruple homicide case from 2010. Officer Wyman was at the scene that day.
I was a canine handler at the time, and I was driving around that morning, and a call went out, and it was requesting for backup. There were two officers that were at a location, and they needed another officer there to help secure a scene.
What did you know about the scene before you had arrived?
I knew they had forced entry because they saw blood. I knew that something had happened. I didn't know exactly what had happened, but there were exigent circumstances for them to believe that somebody could have been or was injured inside the house due to what they had seen at that time. It originally started out as a check on welfare. I want to say it was the mother of the victim couldn't get a hold of her daughter. And so it started out as that. And then when the officer got there to check on the welfare, she started seeing indicators and things that stood out that caused great concern. The backup officer had gotten there. They forced entry. And then when they made entry, what they discovered at that point, they were like, okay, we need more people here.
And what had been discovered? Do you know what was discovered at that point?
When I got there, there was a woman that was laying right inside the front door. So when you go into the house, if you're facing north and you're coming in, the main entrance was on the south side. So when you come in, if you look to your left, there's like a living room area. If you look to your right, there's like a kitchen, dining room, and that's also where the garage was. And then there's a hallway that shoots straight down from the front door. And then in that hallway, there's a bathroom immediately to the right. And then there's, a three-bedroom split plan. So there's two bedrooms on one side, and then there's another bedroom and a bathroom on the other side. And then all the way at the back end, on the north end, is the door, the back door, which leads into the backyard.
Mm-hmm. And so you get there, and take me through what happens when you get there.
I get there, they're already posted in the hallway at that point. I see there's this woman that's laying in front of the doorway inside the house. There's a lot of blood. There's, you can definitely tell something really bad happened. Of course, we're not at that point. We're in investigation stage. We're worried about, is there anybody else in the house? Is there anybody that's still alive? Is there somebody in here that actually committed the crime that's still in here? So I have a tactical background because I was an entry operator for our SWAT team for 5 years. So when I get there, I immediately take point, meaning I take the lead because I had the most experience at that time. We start going down the hallway. We go to the first room on the right side, and it's a bathroom, a very small bathroom, a sink, a toilet, a bathtub, standard little bathroom, basically. And when I flip on the light, I look into the tub, and I see two deceased juveniles in the tub. And I remember I got on the radio, and I was like, I've got two deceased juveniles in the bathtub. And then I literally just turn around and walk right back out. Like, I don't think twice about it because I'm in this hunter mode, if you will. I want to find whoever did this and make sure that they're not still in the house. And if they are, I want to be able to address that.
Yeah.
So we go through, we clear the rest of the house. And then when we get done clearing the rest of the house, at that point, we realize we have a horrific crime scene, and we realize we don't want to touch anything. We don't want to tamper with anything. We don't want to manipulate anything. So we do our best to try to get out, and we try to find the best point or vantage point where we think the forensics teams and all of them are going to want to use to access the house, to get in, to be able to do what they're going to need to do. So we end up going back out through the garage.
Just to be clear, you saw the woman in by the front door, and then the two children,
yes,
in the bathroom, pretty much,
yes,
that first room on the right there.
Yes.
And it's clear to you that these two children are deceased? They're in the bathtub?
Yes. They're in the bathtub, basically floating in the water there. And the water's filled up almost to the top. So you can tell there's two.
Okay. And so what happens next?
So we get out. Obviously the whole world's coming. All the different teams are coming. The homicide investigators, the forensic investigators. They're bringing in all of the bells and whistles for this thing. And we start being told we can start interviewing. And there's a whole bunch of people that are starting to, like, from the neighborhood and stuff, because obviously, you know, everybody's starting to be curious about what's going on. And this woman approaches me, and she says, was Brandy in the house? And I said, who? And she said, my daughter. And I identified it was the mom who had originally called. And she said, did you find my grandbabies? And of course, you know, I'm at this point, I'm not wanting to say, yeah, I found them. They're dead in the bathtub. I told him, I said, there's two that have been identified in there. And she goes, well, what about the third one? And I said, what do you mean? And she said, the little boy. And I said, what are you talking about? She said, there were three. There were two girls that are twins, and there's a little boy that should be in there that's about 3 years old. So I went back to my supervisor. I said, hey, this woman is saying that there's supposed to be three children. And he said, okay, take an ID tech with you and go back in and go look in the bathtub and tell me what you find.
You really were thinking he's got to be there in the bathtub?
That was the only thing I could think of, was if he's in there, that's the only place I could think of that maybe we might have possibly missed.
So you go back in focused on the bathtub, the bathroom.
Yes, yes. And then, of course, when we go back in, you can tell that there's the two girls, and then you can see that the little boy is up underneath the two girls.
I mean, I can't imagine what that was like to discover that.
It was the hardest moment of my law enforcement career. I bawled my eyes out right there. The ID tech and I both hugged each other and we cried, because there wasn't a whole lot more that we could do at that point. It was a very solemn moment, if you will.
And then what happens?
So then we go back out and we confirm that there's three children in the tub, and we have the victim that, or the mother that's in the front. The scene is turned over to homicide and the investigators.
What do we learn later about the situation? What happened that day?
Basically, what we find out is that what we believe was over child support led to a very violent encounter where Brandy, the mother, was shot. and then there were two girls and the little boy that were killed, and they were put in the bathtub, all by the same person.
Did you say it was a custody situation? So the little boy is his child, right?
Yes, yes. He was trying to avoid paying child support, and she was at that point where she was going to go and file for child support. They got into what sounds like a very violent encounter that night, whether it started out as an argument and it went heated and he went off the deep end. Nobody really knows, except for the people that were in the room that night, exactly how that switch happened. But somehow that switch happened. And, you know, like I said, he killed her, he killed the two girls, the twins, and he killed his own son.
He was just found guilty recently, right? The verdict just came down recently,
yes.
Right?
Yes. This was the second trial. The first trial, we had a hung jury, and this was the second trial. And this trial, they deliberated about 4 hours, I believe, before they found him guilty.
And what was his sentence?
Life in prison.
Did you have to take part in the trial at all, or?
I did. I testified at the beginning of the trial, kind of given the layout of the house, given the layout of what was seen.
Mm-hmm. Now, when this all happened, Sean, had you already started your journey of speaking about traumatic events?
I hadn't written my book yet. I had a son who was 3 years old when I went into that house. My son, who's 11 now, was 3 years old at the time. And, you know, that was really hard on me, you know, because I saw that little boy and the first thing I thought about was my son. But then at the same time, I also recognized how blessed I was that I still had a son that was alive. And when this happened, I just remember I held my son like almost a month. Every night when I got home, I held my son as much as he would let me, you know, as much as a three-year-old will let you hold him, obviously. From that day forward, I've never underestimated the blessings that I have in my life, for sure. And I've seen some pretty bad things. I mean, but that's the worst thing I've ever encountered up to this point in my 20-year career.
How did that impact you personally?
For me, it took a lot of prayer. It took a lot of I mean, you never forget that. I'll never forget what I saw, you know. There's no amount of therapy or counseling or treatment or EMDR therapy or anything like that that's ever gonna remove what I saw. But in that moment, I also recognized the blessings that I had, and I recognized that and I think part of it was because of what I was still dealing with my own stuff a lot, as far as my own personal challenges from my youth. So I was mentally and physically abused from the age of 7 to 10. My stepfather was a drug dealer. My mom was mentally and physically abused for well over 30 years. So we were, you know, mentally, physically, psychologically, we faced a lot of abuse. My stepfather was black. My mom was white. We lived in Washington, D.C., in the suburbs of Seat Pleasant, Maryland. I was like the only white kid in the neighborhood in a very low income. We had no run. We lived in a house. We had no running water. We had no electricity. I wore the same clothes to school every day. I got bullied every day because of being a white, you know, one, because I was a white kid, two, because I was wearing the same clothes to school every day. And I was a very introverted child because I was getting, you know, the daylights beat out of me on a regular basis. My stepfather was addicted to drugs and alcohol. And I had a moment when I was around 10 that my stepfather beat me to the point where I couldn't move for an entire week. And when that happened, I got to this place in my life where I said, I'm never going to let this person hurt me or my mother again. And I premeditated the murder of my stepfather. He had a firearm that he carried in his back pocket that he, you know, swore he would use to kill police officers or anybody that ever got in his way when he was doing what he was doing. So I knew where the gun was. When I healed up enough where I could move again, I packed my backpack. I walked into the bedroom. I grabbed the gun out of the back left pocket I stood at the center of the bed. My mom was on the right side. My stepfather was on the left side. I punched the gun out. I pointed it right at my stepfather's head. I started to pull the trigger, and I got to the point where the gun should have gone bang.
Inside Crime is brought to you by DeTerra. The DeTerra drug deactivation pouch provides an easy and effective way to get rid of unused or expired medication. The DeTerra pouch makes addictive drugs like opioids unusable in minutes. Just place the medication in the pouch and mix with water. Be a part of America's solution to reduce drug abuse. Learn more at DeTerraSystem.com. Stay safe, stay ready with DeTerra.
I stood at the center of the bed. My mom was on the right side. My stepfather was on the left side. I punched the gun out. I pointed it right at my stepfather's head. I started to pull the trigger, and I got to the point where the gun should have gone bang, and I truly call it divine intervention in that moment, because for whatever reason, I stopped. I took my finger out of the trigger. I sat the gun between my mom and my stepfather, who were both sound asleep. They never moved. I walked out. I picked up my backpack. I left. And that began my journey into foster care. I was in foster care from the age of 10 until I was 18 years old. And then, of course, I started falling into I went from being bullied to becoming the bully. I started using alcohol as a coping mechanism to be able to deal with the pain and the frustration of all the stuff that had happened to me. I hated my mother because I felt like my mom had abandoned me and put me in foster care. Probably went through at least 4 or 5 of those situations before I was 15, and I finally landed into a decent foster home where they actually cared, and that got me through to where I barely graduated high school, but I graduated high school. But what a lot of people don't realize is when I started my job as a police officer after 8 years in the military, I hated my mother. I was drinking on a regular basis to the point where I was blacking out. I was $150,000 in debt. I'd just gone through a divorce. I was a single father to a brand new newborn child, and I was starting my job at the Tallahassee Police Department. And when I started my job there, now I'm the one that's going to go out and I'm expected to go serve the public. I'm supposed to go out and help the victims. And I'm still a victim myself, Angeline. I thought I could just take all of the bad things that had happened, put it into the back of my subconscious brain, and as long as nobody found out, I could hide it and it wouldn't impact anybody. It wouldn't affect me and I could just move on. And what I discovered is that's just not the case. It doesn't work that way. You just can't put something away, lock it up, and never deal with it again, because at some point, something's going to happen that's going to lead to you having to bring those moments back up, having to bring those emotions back up. And what I discovered as I was starting my law enforcement career, my peers, my supervisors were like, hey, you know, you don't smile a whole lot. You don't, when you talk to people, you're just very direct and straightforward. It's almost like you're robotic. You don't have a personality. And, you know, I blamed it on the military. I was like, look, man, I was an Army Ranger for 8 years, and that's just the way I am. That's just, you know, that's just the way I do things. But the truth was, I was angry. I was pissed off. I was a drunk. I was still, you know, in a really bad place myself, but I really wanted this career. I really wanted to be a police officer. I really wanted to go serve others so that they didn't become victims like I was and my mother was. I truly wanted to go out there and serve with a servant's heart. And what I discovered was the people that I wanted to go out and help, I was actually hurting because I hadn't fixed myself and I hadn't addressed my own issues. And it came to a point where I came to recognition with that and decided to address that and move forward with that. I started going to church. I never didn't believe in God, but I never really reached out to God either. I never really felt like, what do I owe you, right? What do I owe you? All the crap I've been through, you've never been there for me. You allowed all this crap to happen to me. Why should I, reach out to you? And that was kind of my attitude, is I believed that he was there, but I didn't feel like I had anything to prove to him, and I didn't feel like I owed him anything. And that was my attitude for a long time until I actually went to this retreat. And when I went to this retreat, I had this divine moment where I recognized through a scripture that said, in order to be forgiven, so you also must forgive. And that scripture grabbed me so hard and got my attention and made me realize I can't live the life that I'm truly meant to live, and I can't serve in the place I really want to serve if I don't go back and fix what's broken.
So that was almost a decade ago. You've come a long way since then.
Yeah. But you bring up a great point, because it doesn't just flip. You don't just flip a switch and, okay, I'm okay now. Everything's good. You know, it took a long time to get to emotional destruction. It took a long time to get out of it. And I think that's something that we don't realize sometimes. We think that, you know, we go to a bad scene and you go, oh, well, it's just a bad call. You know, they'll come out of it. And the truth is, sometimes it can take a long time for you to come out of something like that, to be able to especially if you've never seen that before, or never dealt with that before, or never addressed that before, or never been mentally prepared for that before you walk into it.
Or sometimes you can be somewhere and then it takes a little while to hit you, I think. You know, a couple days later, you find yourself reacting to, you know, emotionally to whatever it is that you just saw.
Very true. Very true.
Especially in law enforcement, you encounter these situations and then you got to go right back to the job. It's like, you know, you got to still get up the next day and do it all over again.
That was the challenge with this. Is the very next day, I'm back in my patrol car with my dog on the street working after I saw that scene. If any administrators are listening to this right now, please, 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 I beg you, put a peer-to-peer program together. Have your supervisors start learning about doing after-action reviews on critical incident scenes, whether they're minor critical incidents or major critical incidents. They're still critical incidents, and trauma affects everybody differently. What may not be traumatic to you as a supervisor may have been very traumatic to the young rookie that just got on your squad. And, you know, it's really, really important, because I'll never forget that we didn't have anybody come talk to us. We didn't have anybody go, hey, did you go talk to somebody? Would you like to talk to somebody? Would you like to talk to a chaplain? We didn't have a chaplain reach out. You know, there was nothing. And I think about that and I go, man, that could have made a difference. And I know that there was a lot of people that went through a lot of pain in this case. This was not those investigators, those forensics people that, you know, that had to do the work that they did without going into the gruesome details. There was a lot of pain. There was a lot of suffering. And we wonder why we have so much when it comes to the post-traumatic stress injury, post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, divorce, self-harm, promiscuous behavior, suicide. I mean, the list goes on and on. We wonder why we have these issues. And I believe a big part of it is lack of preparation. You know, that's just definitely something that we as a whole, and not just law enforcement, dispatchers, corrections, firefighters, EMS, they all need to do a better job with this, of creating these, having some form of a peer-to-peer program in place, having things in place so when situations like this happen, you can address it immediately rather than letting them just go home and sleep on it. You know, have a conversation, and it doesn't have to be a deep conversation at that time. It may just be a wellness check, just to go, hey, listen, that I know that was a really bad scene. Look, chances are you may not be able to sleep tonight. You may have a hard time eating. If any of those things happen, do me a favor. Call me. Here's my number. I don't care what time of night it is. Give me a call. And just so I can, you know, if we need to talk, we can talk. If we, you know, whatever it is. But sometimes it's just knowing that we have something. Something is so much better than nothing at all.
A lot of times what happens then is that person holds it in and then goes to work the next day and goes to the next event. experiences another thing, and then holds that in. And over time, then they're dealing with a lot of suppressed stuff, right?
Yes. Yes, exactly. Our culture has created this stigma that you have to be tough. You have to deal with it. I remember being in the academy 20 years ago and them sitting there and going, you're going to have a high divorce rate. You're going to have a high suicide rate. You're going to have alcoholism. Some of you are going to get arrested for beating your kids, right? I mean, I remember them. And it was almost like bragging rights, kind of. And, you know, I was single at the time. I didn't think twice about it. I was like, okay, whatever. Where do I sign? I need a job and I want to do this. Let's go. But then I thought about it and I go, they never told us why. They never told us how. They never really got into the, you know, this is why this is going to happen. They just said it was going to happen. So we've known that it happens. We've known it's happened for years and years and years, decades, right? But yet the trend keeps climbing. Suicides keep going up dramatically. Self-harm. And now we're having problem with retention. Now we're having problem with people taking wellness days and losing money. We're having problem with people getting embarrassed and making mistakes that are leading to millions and millions of dollars in lawsuits that could have been avoided. We talk about high liabilities. We talk about shooting. We talk about driving. We talk about fighting when it comes to law enforcement, how to protect ourselves, how to recognize resistance and the type of force that we need to do to address that resistance. When a deadly force encounter happens, how to address that. We do that really, really well. But we miss the mark on the fourth high liability, which is our mental health. We do not discuss mental health at the level that it needs to be discussed. And yet it is the number one killer in our industry right now. I've had personal close friends that have lost their lives in the line of duty. So I don't want to take away from their honor at all. But we are killing ourselves far more with our own hand than by any other hand that's trying to kill us.
Well, a lot has to change, that's for sure. And it starts, I think, by talking about it. And you are part of that change because you're talking about it. You've written how many books now?
Second one is on its way out, and it's actually focused on mental health fitness for public safety professionals. It is a book, a training guide for public safety professionals to help them to understand that the mental health aspect of our jobs. So my first book, it's about my story and what I went through, the divine intervention, and then the process that I learned that brought me out of it.
How is this book different than your first book?
I wanted to tell the dark side, but I also wanted to let everybody know that in every adverse moment, no matter how bad it seems, there is an opening. There is a light at the end of the tunnel. There is an opportunity to become better and to do something positive with the most adverse situations. So that's what that first book was about. It was focused on me and my story and then the lessons and the values and the movement process, right? Which is the process that I talk about in that book that helped to get me through it. And I believe it will help other people that are in those situations as well. This book focuses on public safety professionals. It focuses on training. It focuses on mental health. It focuses on the science behind why things happen the way they happen when we're on the street. It talks about hypervigilance. It talks about why we have challenges in our relationships. And the book really focuses on bridging the gaps between you and the communities that you serve, improving upon your relationships between your personal relationships and your professional relationships, reducing liability, increasing or improving upon your mental health, if you will, your mental fitness, improving that so that you can live the higher quality life that you deserve to live. So when you retire, you can enjoy the retirement that you've worked so hard for. And most importantly, Angeline, it's about saving lives. It's about giving people something that helps them to have a structure that actually creates a tactical emotional adversity management system, just like we have systems for shooting, just like we have tactics and we have teams for shooting and driving and defensive tactics. I want to have a teams program for mental health, and that's what this is about, is creating a tactical emotional adversity management system that does just that. So when they get done reading that book, even when they read the very first chapter of that book, they're going to be able to take what they have and they can start applying it. So whether you're a brand new officer, maybe not even in the academy yet, but you pick this book up as you're going through the criminal justice program, you're already going to have such a huge advantage over 99% of the organizations out there that are currently serving in our industry right now, because you're going to have such a wealth of knowledge and understanding to apply that by the time you get into the academy, you're going to be able to apply this just in the academy. And then you're a brand new rookie, you're getting out there. When you go out and you're dealing with these families and these people that are broken from their own adverse experiences from childhood and beyond, you already have a better understanding of how to interact with them, how to communicate with them, how to recognize when aggression is towards you and when it's not, when to recognize what is true resistance and what is aggravation towards a system or aggravation towards something else, so that you don't go out and make the mistakes and get into an unnecessary liability issue where you're the next YouTube sensation. But you also are in a place where you can genuinely do what we were called to do in this profession, which was serve, help, and protect. But we're not just the first line of defense. We can also now be the first line of healing. And that's really what this book does.
What is the name of the book, Sean?
The name of the book is Going Beyond the Call, Mental Health Fitness for Public Safety Professionals.
Well, it sounds like, I know you talk a lot about how it should be something that they should read in the academy, but it sounds like this is information for anyone, no matter what stage they're in their career.
You know what? And yeah, thank you for clarifying that, Angeline, because I covered it from the youngest officer because I believe that's where the culture is going to change. But you're absolutely right. From the 5-year officer to the 10 to the 15 to the 20 to the 25 to the 30, and even those that have just retired or been in retirement a while that are suffering. Because you know what? A lot of people don't open the vault until they retire and they don't have anything to do anymore. They don't have a title anymore. They don't have the authority anymore. They're sitting on their lounge chair one day. They're watching the Price is Right. And all of a sudden, these emotions start kicking in. Or they're riding their bike and they hear a train off in the distance. And all of a sudden, it brings this rush of memories of things that happened during their 30-year career where they saw these incidents with trains involved. And it happens. It happens more than we want to admit, and it's definitely something that we need to address, and I'm really excited that I've been blessed and called upon to take on the fight.
Well, thank you so much for everything you're doing. You just never know when you're going to impact somebody, whether they're in a small group or in a large auditorium, so thank you for taking the time to do that. And you're still working, and you have a family, so you got a lot on your plate, sir.
Yes, I do.
Thank you so much for taking the time to be on our show. We appreciate it.
It was an honor and a pleasure, and thank you so much, Angeline, for giving me the opportunity. I greatly appreciate it.
And that's it for this edition of Inside Crime. Thank you so much for listening. For more information about our podcast, check out our website, insidecrime.com. And be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode of Inside Crime.